Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome to Administrative Static. This is John Vecchione. I'm here, as always, with Mark Chenoweth of NCLA. But we are extremely pleased that we have a special guest today, Dan McLaughlin, known to some of you as Baseball Crank. He is a reformed attorney, I think you might say. He used to practice. I don't think he practices anymore. Now he writes on legal topics for National Review. You can find his work at nationalreview.com, and you can also find it on Twitter under the handle Baseball Crank. And he writes on a myriad of legal topics. And today's topic is the vaccine mandates that were issued by OSHA and also the Medicare and Medicaid vaccine mandates. And Mark and I have discussed that in the past, but the Supreme Court Thursday before last had argument on this. It was pretty lively and a lot went on. And Dan has written an article on it, but we'd like to get his thoughts. So just as a little background, I'll just say the OSHA mandate is the one that we've discussed before, where the Department of Labor has said that any company with over 100 employees has to test and wear masks or have all their employees vaccinate, or they can be terminated. And Medicare, Medicaid is anyone receiving those funds from Medicare or Medicaid has to set up a similar program for healthcare workers. So Dan, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
And you've written on this. What did you make of the, it was sort of a two-tiered, it was a long oral argument between the both of them. Why don't you just give us what your thoughts were just from a 10,000-foot view? What did you think?
Yeah, it was a very long dual argument. I confess that I, you know, after sitting through the entire OSHA argument, I did not quite absorb the entire Medicare argument, which we'll get to in a minute. It's actually, I think, more technical than the OSHA one. You know, I think essentially where we are, the core question in these cases is, you know, did Congress give the relevant agencies, OSHA and, you know, CMS, which, you know, runs Medicare and Medicaid, did it give them clear enough statutory authority that they're allowed to cram down these mandates? You know, I think there's the language that they have in the OSHA statute, certainly, you know, it's pretty broad. It is the question is almost, is it too broad? And is it really, is this really the kind of thing it's aimed at? Right. It's pretty clear that the OSHA statute was aimed to a large extent when it was written at, you know, workplace hazards created by, you know, machinery and that sort of thing.
The nature of the work.
You know, yeah, the nature of the work. And, you know, the CMS one is somewhat more abstruse. You know, the court is not likely to rule on the question of whether Congress had the authority to issue these mandates. That's really not what's being challenged. You know, if Congress had written a statute saying that OSHA and CMS could do this, you know, I think there would still be some significant constitutional questions about whether that's really part of Congress's power. But for the most part, the arguments assume that Congress does have the power, and it's really a question of whether or not that power was delegated clearly to the agencies. You know, and the side question on top of that is, did these agencies really have the authorization to do this on an emergency basis in a way that bypasses the normal notice and comment procedures for administrative action. You know, and I think they're on kind of shaky ground there, and some of the justices seemed concerned about that, Justice Barrett, I think, in particular.
This is a good spot to talk about that. Why don't you talk about what an emergency power is and why it is a little dicey for the government to claim it now?
Yeah, and that, I mean, that it varies based on the two statutes, again, but, I mean, in the OSHA area, they're allowed to issue what sort of called an emergency temporary standard, which those traditionally have not done great in court, because it essentially is the idea that the government has to, you know, react quickly to some grave danger, and so doesn't have time to go through the customary process. And, you know, what they did here, first of all, the mandates were announced by the White House in, I think, September. Of 2021. And so, you know, this is quite a long time after, not only after the vaccines were made widely available, but quite a long time after Joe Biden came into office. So you can't even sort of say, well, you know, they didn't do this earlier because you had a different president and different administration policy. You know, so they waited a while to announce this. And then after announcing it, they waited quite a while to actually issue the rules. And so, you know, the argument normally is that an ETS, an emergency measure, is essentially a stopgap, right? That the agency doesn't really have time to do a full kind of thorough, you know, cost benefit analysis, but it's allowed to move a little more swiftly because it's dealing with a grave crisis. And here you had, you know, quite a long time. You know, you can't just, I think the courts are going to be skeptical of any claim that you have this kind of permanent emergency authority, right? That emergency authority is open-ended. You can take as much time as you want. It can last as long as you want. So I think that's something that clearly at least Justice Barrett was concerned about. You know, I think the court, particularly on the OSHA mandate.
When does the emergency end, right? That was her question.
And
I guess to some extent, when does it begin? Given that this has gone on for some time, so we don't know as we speak today what the court did, but this was a preliminary injunction. Now, one of the things that I found interesting was that the OSHA, at least the OSHA case, everybody on earth filed in every circuit in the country, right, and then the Fifth Circuit stayed the operation of this OSHA mandate. And then it got moved to the Sixth Circuit on like a wheel of figuring out which circuit should take the whole case. And the Sixth Circuit then said, nope, no stay. And then that is what's been appealed, at least in the OSHA case, to the Supreme Court. And they haven't issued an administrative stay. What do you make of that?
It is strange. Didn't really fight Justice Alito when he was asking, well, what if we just put in an administrative stay briefly to decide this case? And I think she recognized that, you know, if the administration loses a week, you know, it's not necessarily the biggest loss in the world.
Right. But you don't make anything of the fact that they haven't done it as reading the tea leaves one way or another.
I think my tea leaf reading on it mainly is that if they haven't issued an administrative stay, it probably means they're trying to get the decision done quickly. And so they're just trying to forge ahead with that rather than necessarily fight over it. But obviously that could be an optimistic sign for the administration that they don't see the necessity of stopping this thing in its tracks. But I think overall where the court seems to be right now is kind of a 3-3-3 split on this, right? I mean, you have, you know, the three liberal justices very clearly are going to support anything the administration does in this area. And you have, I think, three votes, Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch, who are pretty deeply skeptical of all of this. And so in the center, in a sense, you have kind of the You know, you have not only Roberts, but I think Barrett and Kavanaugh both take a very kind of institutional view of administrative power. You know, they kind of want to go care. They want to tread carefully. They want to draw distinctions. The sense I got is that the three of them were all potentially interested in telling the administration that it had acted too broadly, too quickly, or too slowly, or too quickly and too slowly, as it may be, you know, and essentially send them back to do a little this more narrowly, because I think the concern that the, you know, the seizure of and applying it to every workplace in the country above a certain size is just, it's a one size fits all thing that doesn't make
right. And I think that they mentioned that some people are outdoors. There's all various things going on. And what about the people in companies that have fewer than 100,000 workers? You know, I think 100 workers, excuse me. And then the other issue that I am at least it sounded like to me. And I'm wondering if this is not affecting people like Kavanaugh. You also followed the CDC eviction moratorium, and at New Civil Liberties, we litigated quite a few of those cases. And the administration said there was all this parade of horribles that was going to happen, that these things were absolutely vital. And then when it went away, there was no parade of horribles. And Kavanaugh's, you know, giving the administration a little rope. First time it went up there, they slapped him across the face and just went ahead with what they were going to do anyway. I mean, I wonder if some of this COVID litigation has maybe opened the court's eyes to be a little more jaundiced of administration and Trump administration as well. Administration claims. Oh,
yeah,
we'll be right back. Well, I'll have him answer that question after the break. And we're back at Administrative Static with our guest, Dan McLaughlin. And we had just asked him whether maybe Kavanaugh has been affected by some of the previous COVID-related litigation that's come before the Supreme Court. What do you think, Dan?
Yeah, I think, you know, it used to be once upon a time that when the Solicitor General talked, when a presidential administration talked to the court, they carried an enormous amount of credibility. And that was true kind of regardless of, you know, which administration it was and which justices it was. And I think we've seen a big shift away from that. There was a shift away from that during the Trump years. You know, I think it predates Trump even. But, you know, and I think that there's some issues with that here as well, that the court doesn't really totally trust that the administration is being sensible or being honest with it about everything. And that's why you have so much of, you know, so much talk about, well, what is the administration saying publicly outside of court compared to what its legal position is? You know, that was the thing
I think Roberts even asked about something Ron Klain had tweeted. And you're on Twitter. I did not. I think before the last administration, there wasn't a lot of citation by Supreme Court justices to Twitter.
So, yeah, it was even a retweet by Klain. It wasn't even something Klain had said, but it was something he effectively endorsed about this being a workaround.
Retweets are not endorsements.
I mean, with the CDC eviction case, you basically had Biden come right out and say he was just, you know, he knew he didn't have a legal leg to stand on. He was just trying to buy time. And the court was not amused by that. And, you know, this time around, I think the sense is that, you know, the Biden administration is clearly trying to work around. They're trying to find a way to cobble together a number of different statutes and different powers, you know, vaccine mandates under OSHA for the workplace, under CMS for, you know, the healthcare sector, vaccine mandates for the military, vaccine mandates for, you know, federal government contractors, federal government employees. And I think that that gets into some interesting areas doctrinally, because, you know, traditionally what the court's job is supposed to be is to sit down in each case and look at the statute and say, you know, has Congress authorized this or not? And you know, the court kind of trusted that the statutory authority question was fairly, that's really all they need to do. But I think there, you know, there is this what's called the major questions doctrine, which is basically it's really a presumption, right? It's a way of saying, look, the bigger a question is and the more divisive a national question is, the less we are going to presume that Congress just intended, without saying so explicitly, you know, that to extend administrative authority over this, right? If it's, you know, can you ban smoking, or can you, you know, if it, can you regulate guns? Can you pass climate change authority? And we've seen this a number of times now recently, where some administration gets it in its head that it wants to pursue some goal. It doesn't have across the board statutory authority. So it goes to a bunch of different agencies and says, okay, how can you pursue this goal? And can you find something in your statute that is general enough that will let you do it? And I think if the statutory authority is clear and explicit, that shouldn't be a problem, right? A presidential administration should be able to use whatever tools it has at hand to pursue the policies it was elected to pursue. You know, I mean, that's frankly, that's how, like, you know, Abe Lincoln fought the Civil War, right? He looked at what are the tools he's been given, you know, and what various administrations did, you know, in the Cold War, the Depression or whatever. I mean, I guess the Depression's maybe a bad example in terms of modest use of administrative authority.
But I think the famous one with Lincoln is declaring slaves contraband, right? And then that's how they could take quote unquote property. And that was some good lawyering, I thought. But here, so the major question doctrine, it I think the way it's been used is whether or not it's affected major amounts of the economy, the number of people, that sort of thing. And I guess what Roberts was getting at in his questioning is, well, I'm going to ask you about this. You just said that they're going to every agency and saying, what can you do for us on vaccine mandates? And Solicitor General Preligar, who, by the way, I think did an excellent job. I thought she was great. You know, that's an admission against interest on my side, because obviously I think that these mandates are not authorized. But I thought she did a great job. But she did respond that there's no general order to all the agencies. And I think that the president has issued executive orders that are explicitly that. So I don't know how accurate that was for someone who I think did a great job. But tell us about the major questions doctrine. Could that get a Roberts or a Kavanaugh on the side of the Gorsuchites?
Yeah, and I think, again, it's entirely possible that it will get them part of the way on that side. I mean, again, what is unusual about this, and you know, whether or not Preligar is being entirely strictly accurate there, there's no question that the president's policy, which has been quite effectively communicated, is that he wants to use every lever of federal power available to reach the same end of mandating vaccines as broadly as he can. And what is unusual is that normally the major questions doctrine, the court has a case, right? The court has a case. There's a statute. There's C. And the court is saying, do we think that Congress meant to give this agency this power? And what is unusual here is that you have multiple cases, multiple agencies, multiple different statutes. And And so is the court going to step back and say, wait a minute, maybe instead of just deciding whether OSHA was given this power or CMS was given this power, we're going to look at the fact that the administration is using a bunch of these statutes simultaneously to pursue the same end. And maybe that's a sign that we can consider as a legal matter that this is, in fact, a major question that, you know, that Congress, you know, Congress should have weighed in on. And if Congress didn't weigh in on it explicitly, that it didn't really mean by passing a bunch of these different general statutes in, you know, different decades, different Congresses, different policy areas that were all aimed to give the federal, you know, administrative branch, you know, this kind of sweeping authority to reach mandates into every corner it can reach.
Right. And that your colleague at NRO, Andy McCarthy, took seriously Justice Sotomayor's question that under the Commerce Clause, doesn't the federal government basically have police power? So the Jacobson case was that the states are allowed to do something, at least with vaccine mandates. That's a 1905 case. But that there's always been this idea that the states have general power and the federal government only has delegated power. And some would say that the state constitutions are delegated power as well. But let's put that aside. There's a lot of precedent out there that states have police power, meaning a general ability to legislate in areas of health, safety, and morals, and the federal government doesn't. And Sotomayor took a broadsword to that idea, said, no. What do you make of that?
I mean, I think it's I agree with Andy. While it displays a certain ignorance on Sotomayor's part of how the Constitution was written, she is certainly representing a particular and very popular on her side of the aisle view of how the Constitution actually is read today. I mean, this is a debate that goes all the way back. I mean, if you go back to even like Gibbons versus Ogden, you know, Chief Justice Marshall is talking about, you know, there are certain things that states, we don't question that states can't be, you know, federal authority can't displace, say, state quarantine laws, right? So this is an old debate. I mean, I think what's kind of alarming, though, is that if you say that the federal government has these powers under the Commerce Clause, then the logical next step may be to say that the states don't have them anymore, that the federal government preempted the field. And I think Preligar actually said this at the argument, essentially, that you know, she thought that the federal government has kind of preempted the field in this area, which would be a very, very dramatic statement. And you know, to a certain extent, I think the court should be alarmed by the idea that if it accepts a view that de facto uses these broad statutes to give the authority to do this to the federal government, it is also implicitly saying that the states have been precluded from the field, that the states have lost their power over, you know, health and safety. And that seems like a very, very alarming reach.
I had missed that implication, actually, in that it would be something, you know, the whole preemption area, the Supreme Court is, if it's implicit preemption, the Supreme Court monitors that pretty closely rather than explicit. I mean, sometimes like nuclear regulation, right? The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, I always use nuclear because the federal government invented it and has all the patents and everything. And so they've said, we're in charge of nuclear stuff, right? But they don't say that very often. And so the court has to say, hey, was it impliedly done? And I think that's a big stretch, but that's a good point. Well, we only have a few minutes left. So I was wondering if in closing, you know, you have a couple of minutes. Is there anything that you think we should take away from the argument? Go ahead. I'm going to give you the last final thoughts.
Well, we'll wait and see. But I don't be surprised if this is a fractured split decision that, you know, upholds some federal power, but restrains some of it.
Yeah. And waits to come up again before them. Well, I want to thank our guest for joining us in a fascinating discussion. And it was really good. Thanks for coming back. We'll be right back.